Hello, and welcome to the Brad Pitt cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt. I fucked up his name. He's the opposite of Brad Pitt.
He's good Pitt.
He's the best Pitt. My name is Joseph.
I'm Dan.
And this is our episode about the film, the Robert Redford film, A River Runs Through It.
A River Runs Through It.
Which solidifies Brad Pitt and changes the narrative for our podcast. We've been commenting a lot about how this podcast so far, we haven't been able to talk about Pitt's choices. We've just been like, he's been buffeted about the winds. This is the film that's like, oh, everyone's like, oh, that's the guy. He's the guy.
Yeah, he's a star.
He's the boy. Because he's been hot, but now he's like serious and cute and all of the things that matter to him.
He has levels.
He has levels.
He might win an Oscar. That's the kind of vibe.
So that's nominally what this episode of the podcast is about. There is an extremely pressing Brad Pitt matter.
Brad Pitt news. We need a little
klaxon.
A siren, yeah.
If we had a producer.
This is where they'd come in. If you want to audition to be our producer, email us at thebradpittcast@gmail.com.
What would that audition look like? If you can name more than two Brad Pitt films.
Actually, no. Send in a sound. Send in a sound for the Brad Pitt news broadcast.
The klaxon. Whatever it is, it's right here. Here it goes. Dropped in. No one will fucking send us. They'll just be silence. Well, I mean, this episode won't be out anyway. So
it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work that way. Breaking Brad Pitt news. The Oscar cycle the Oscar cycle has started.
Yeah.
I was quite concerned that despite having the capacity to be nominated for Best Actor for Ad Astra and Best Supporting for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, he will almost definitely win Supporting. Unless he says something silly and pisses people off. I genuinely think he has a strong chance. So despite the fact that...
What a coup that would be for the Brad Pitt cast.
Oh, we'd be fucked. We'd be so... We were talking today, we were like...
No, I mean if he won. It would be a great thing.
Sure.
I understand what you mean.
If he said... If the culture turns against Brad Pitt in this moment, what are we doing? We're wasting our last, the sad Pitt cast. We have to do a really mournful episode where we have to be like, I'm really sorry.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Brad, don't let us down. He hasn't before.
No. He never could.
No, he never could.
This will look so bad in retrospect. It's fine. We won't talk about it.
If he does something that bad, we'll self-combust the entire podcast. We'll burn it. We'll have a switch. We'll have a kill switch.
Yeah, we were thinking about doing a Cameron Diaz podcast.
Yeah, we'll just switch. So despite the fact that he has the possibility to win not one but two Oscars...
That would be wild if he won Supporting and Best. Ah.
I don't think Ad Astra has the longevity.
No.
It will only get a Best Actor nomination if people like the narrative enough of like Brad Pitt's number one.
Yeah.
Here he is with two.
He's coming home.
Do you know what he was nominated Best Actor for?
I don't.
Moneyball.
Oh, that's right. Of course.
Do you know who he lost against?
I don't.
Fucking Jean Dujardin for The Artist.
Oh.
Isn't that the worst thing you've ever heard?
I've actually never seen The Artist, but it still depresses me.
There was a year, that was the year that The Artist just like fucking swept the Oscars, despite the fact people laugh about Avatar, like, no one remembers Avatar. Who the fuck remembers The Artist?
That's a cultural... I feel like actually Best Picture Oscar winners predicts for films that will be forgotten from the cultural memory.
It's true.
It's really extraordinary.
Well, there was a really smart piece, I think it was by Guy Lodge, talking about the fact that like, everyone was so mad about fucking, what's his name? Played Freddie Mercury. Terrible actor, I think. Mr. Robot.
Yeah.
Whatever his fucking name is. John Robot.
Have you seen that very creepy ad he does?
Yes. I do not like
him. He's not a good actor.
I do not like him. Rami Malek.
Queen film on a plane.
Piece of shit.
It was extraordinarily bad. I watched the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's actually not a bad plane film in that you don't feel like you're losing anything for watching it on a plane.
It's cheese. It's like,
it's extraordinary. I mean, I don't like Queen, the band. I'll put it out there right now.
They're the worst band.
Great. I'm glad we agree on that. Yeah. I find none of them, I would never, ever, ever be walking down the street and think, I want to listen to a Queen song.
No.
It's never happened. It will never happen.
No, I hate them. I straight up hate Queen. Yeah, the story of Queen is the story of a band that did a lot, rising to the top in an era where no band is doing anything.
Yeah.
That's my hottest
take. Ornament. Baroque ornament.
But I usually love Baroque, but nothing going on. It's all ornament and it's really daggy and it sucks.
It's poetically uninteresting. It's dull. It's overlong.
Everyone who's like, big smart band, forget that they released a song that's called like, I Want to Ride My Bicycle.
Yeah.
It goes like, I want to ride my bicycle. Just over and over again.
It's a bad song.
Fuck
that. It's not even, and it's also... It's not even sincere.
No.
Yeah.
But you see, this is what's interesting about taste, right? You're saying all the things that usually for me, I'm like, Fuck yeah. But I mean, we were saying just before we started recording the podcast that what I like from music is not the same as what I like from cinema. And like the baroqueness, all the stuff that I want from movies in music, I'm like, nah, I don't, I'm not, no thank
you. Interesting.
What was I going to say? Mr. Robot shouldn't have... Oh, yeah, Guy Lodge said that it was actually really bad for Johnny Robot that he won for a not well-liked film that will really date, like, people in 10 years' time will look at the people who made that movie and be like, what was going on?
Particularly because Bryan Singer's in it.
Yeah, directed it.
Yeah.
Well, and then got fired, which is what Rami Malek tried to excuse it on the campaign trail.
I guess, fame destroys us all.
Yeah, it really does.
Except Brad Pitt.
Because he doesn't care.
That's definitely true, which you find out by watching the interview.
Which is what this whole bundle of tangents started with. This morning, despite the fact that it looked like Pitt was not going to do the awardsy stuff, he and Adam Sandler interviewed each other for
Variety. Adam Sandler of Uncut Gems.
Of Uncut Gems, and also of... many fantastic films, which Daniel Dixon
I have does, lukewarm feelings towards.
Is wrong about, objectively wrong. And it's such a fun interview to watch.
It's extraordinary. Yeah, well, look, I haven't seen the whole thing. Joe showed me highlights. I haven't had time today to sit down and watch a 50-minute interview of Adam Sandler and Brad Pitt. But it's so delightful because you get to see Brad Pitt be himself, which turns out is basically Brad Pitt in all his roles.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you very early on this podcast quoted that interview where he was like, you know, he was talking about like,
yeah, it's not pretending. Acting is not pretending. Yeah. It's finding the truth in yourself and clearly showcasing it on screen. Yeah, for sure. All his little mannerisms and quirks, especially his kind of physical expressions.
Yeah.
Entirely himself. He's never, which in descriptively almost sounds like he's not a good actor, but that just turns out not to be the case at all.
Well, because even when you watch him in the interview, there's an element of, I mean, everyone always talks about Brad Pitt's charm, but there isn't a real, I think, intrinsic to him is a dagginess too.
Yeah.
And in that interview,
an easy dagginess.
Yeah. A relaxed, unspecific dagginess. He's kind of a nerd for everything.
He's a nerd about dad.
Everything. Yeah, yeah, he is. Covered in his
bangles. Like, I was thinking bangles that, yeah.
And his old man tattoos.
And his little newsboy cap.
Yeah, his newboy. Does he wear that because his hair is thinning?
I don't know.
He only wears that nowadays.
That's true because now it's a trademark. My suspicion is that it's a disguise option in public because he can like pull it because there's the only reason I think that is because at the end of the interview that I was referring to earlier where he talks about acting not being pretending, the guy profiling him says he kind of pulls his hat down over his eyes and like walks through a crowd of people and they don't recognize him.
Yeah.
So I wonder if it's kind of a transformative
sure
like he can kind of pull it down a bit and not be Brad Pitt.
Sure. And I mean I think the other if we're talking like Oscars love narratives, right? I think people feel about the 1-2 punch of Ad Astra and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is Ad Astra is a reflection on the fact that Brad Pitt has very publicly been in a difficult place. Yeah. Like that profile that you're talking about talks about his experiences with AA. It was quite well known, not that I like referencing tabloid shit, but that drugs were a reason that he and Jolie were like breaking up. There was a problem with those two. And so Ad Astra is a reflection on like, he's been through shit. And Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is like, but he's also fun.
Yeah. So you get the many faces of Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Which are broadly the same person.
Yeah. That reflect on the same thing. Because in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, he's also been
hurt. He's washed up. In both, he's washed up.
Yeah, exactly. But in Ad Astra, it's all like interior. And in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it's kind of transparent. He's like, whatever.
Yeah.
I'm pointing forward.
And both of those, the kind of washed upness of his character is mitigated by the fact that he has a purpose that the universe is calling him towards and he is just happy to commit to that purpose.
Yeah. My friend, the film writer Cam Williams, shout out to Cam Williams, he's the best. He's a real good boy, which is the like somehow become the shorthand on this podcast. Quality. Cam wrote that his character in that film is just looking for a purpose or a chance. And I think that really nails...
Once Upon a Time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's just bumming around. He's looking for, if you have some value system to give me, I'll take it. That's true. If you have something that makes me, like, restores my career, I'll take it.
Which is why The Dog Works. I mean, this is not the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood episode. That's some time away. But which is why The Dog works in that film, right? Because it gives him a function.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why Tarantino just shows you. Yeah, exactly. Tarantino just shows you all that shit.
Mm.
So the only other thing, I guess, that I have to say from the Variety interview, because
which we would genuinely recommend.
It's incredible.
We'll probably tweet it out.
Yeah. The most incredible thing is the number of times Brad Pitt talks about comedy.
Hmm.
He says he's thinking about doing stand-up. Can which you
would be
imagine?
It would be, I adore Brad Pitt. It would be terrible. I think it would be awful. It would be so corny. Do you think he could
swing around to being good again?
No. I think would just be really... I think his charm would... But he has so far to fall. I think that's the problem with stand-up, is you need to be close to the ground. Because if you're not... Just the risk of ruining the room with the slightest incorrect gesture, or like destroying the crowd, or getting them offside, or making them feel awkward, is so great. The consequences of that risk are so great that I think it would just be terrifying watching Brad Pitt doing stand-up.
That's maybe true. You don't think if he had like a tiny layer of artifice, he could be Andy Kaufman?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, that's a wild... I think...
Does he come up with those kind of ideas? I don't think so, because I think he would think comedy would be sincere.
But I think he wants to make some jokes about the differences between men and women, to be honest. Like, he's not stupid, but I don't think he's got a... At least in terms of how he understands himself in relation to the world, I don't think he's getting up and reading Catcher in the Rye until the audience riots.
You don't think...
Which is what Andy Kaufman did.
You don't think he would meet someone else and maybe not generate those ideas himself? Not because he's too stupid, but because it's just not what he's interested in. Meets someone who says to him, hey, you should do this.
Well, so the analog to that would be, say, I'm Not Here. Is that the Joaquin Phoenix? Is that what that's called? The Joaquin Phoenix film where he...
Yeah, yeah. And that's Casey Affleck pulling those strings. Yeah, which
I'm not endorsing. Yeah, that is weird.
No one talks about how weird that is. Because Casey Affleck just disappeared from our culture.
Yeah, we'll never do the Casey Affleck cast, obviously. It'd
be bad. Well, that wouldn't be very... Well, we're going to talk about him. He's in Assassination Jesse James. Mm. But he's a
weirdo.
I just think he does sometimes have, like, formative creative relationships with people like David Fincher. And if he found, like, some weirdo gonzo artist who's, like, maybe, like, a hip-hop guy.
Well, he's friends with a lot of art people in LA.
Yeah. And maybe one of them goes, like, hey, let's do a performance piece, like a Brad Pitt Netflix special. I could almost see him doing, like, children's show presentership.
Yeah. And I can imagine that.
And why? I think it's because he knows he's sincere. And in his best movies... He works with filmmakers who can use that sincerity in some way.
Earnest, right?
Yeah, earnest.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Because I think he has this, like, love-hate relationship with his own earnestness. He's sometimes uncomfortable with it. But
he plays it out, right? He lets that discomfort show physically. I think, that's true. Because I can totally imagine him doing something weird and arty for a reject the audience kind of routine.
Well, because in the Variety interview and in Ad Astra interviews with just like random journos, he keeps talking about Paul Thomas Anderson.
Hmm.
He's in that Variety interview, he's like, he's the master. So maybe if PTA, like,
who is in the LA comedy scene,
gets all of his LA comedy buddies and they...
Brad Pitt does something at Largo.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I can see that. I think it would have... The thing is, Brad Pitt has to be... the fall guy. He has to be, like, not quite the straight man, but he has to be the one who is being humiliated in that context in some way. Otherwise, I don't think it works.
I think that's probably true. You know what's weird? We have talked a lot about Brad Pitt in the opening of the Brad Pitt cast.
First 15 minutes.
We don't usually do that.
No, that's true, actually.
If I was like, why are we talking about Brad Pitt? I think...
It always takes a while to get around to him. Maybe because... He's coming into his own now in...
I think this podcast will, like, naturally reshape itself around the Oscars.
That's probably true.
We will be...
What if he doesn't get nominated?
There's no way he doesn't get nominated.
Okay.
I will give you $200 if he doesn't get a nomination.
All right, I'll take that. It's not a bet. Just give me $200 if he doesn't get a nomination.
Yeah, that's how confident I am. I don't want to gain anything because I'll gain the love of Brad Pitt winning an Oscar. Yeah, there's no way he doesn't.
Okay.
What does Hollywood and the Oscars love?
Yeah. Brad Pitt.
They love Brad Pitt.
They love drama. They love narrative. They love people coming home.
They love self-referential performances about Hollywood.
Yeah.
They love Quentin Tarantino. They've awarded almost every film he's been nominated. It is inevitable. But, you know, this ties into the Variety interview. I used to be like a big Oscars person, and I burnt out really badly because every Oscars race felt like a repeat of the 2016 presidential election. I had no horse to root for, and the horse that I least wanted to win won. Like, that happened so many times. Sure. I was like, why am I playing this game? I don't like it. Like, I remember... How much do I want to get into these formative experiences? I remember when I really started getting into film was around the time that David Cronenberg's A History of Violence came out.
Yeah.
Which remains one of my all-time favorite
films. It's a good film.
It's like top 15 Vigo. Film for me. I think it's one of Cronenberg's best. Like, I think it's extraordinary. And I remember... What are you laughing
about? Nothing. I just your rage.
It looked like Cronenberg was going to get Oscar. He deserved it. He had made a film that fit into some... And David Cronenberg doesn't care about the Oscars.
No.
But I want to see Dave get up on stage with a little gold man and everyone clap for my friend Dave, who's like the artist for me, the number one guy.
One validation.
And he got a fucking Golden Globe nomination and he got no Oscars nominations whatsoever. And then fucking, you know, however many years later, I have the same experience when my other good, close, personal friend who makes movies for me that I love and thank him for, Todd Haynes, makes Carol, which is another case...
The Oscar-baitiest of Todd Haynes films possible.
Another case of an artist who is subversive and interesting, doing subversive and interesting things within a mainstream framework. The Academy should be like, we can give this guy an award now, he's done something that we like, and also we can retroactively honour the fact that he has been making the best American art of the last 100 years. Todd Haynes does not get a Best Director nomination for Carol. And then...
Yeah.
Why do I keep playing a game that hurts me like that, Dan?
I mean, yeah, we return to those who hurt us.
But then I think this year, Brad Pitt. He can restore my faith in this broken institution that means nothing.
Don't invest everything in it.
He won't win. Possibly.
He could.
He has no competitor.
He could
at this
win
stage.
Supporting.
Oh, yeah. That's all he'll win.
He won't win Best Actor.
No.
Not enough people like Ad Astra.
No. And Ad Astra didn't make enough money. That's the other thing. I remember Denis Villeneuve, who's a person we've weirdly talked about a lot.
That's true.
Podcast.
Like 3 or 4 times, I think.
Yeah. Villeneuve talked about Blade Runner 2049 not being recognized at the Oscars despite being like critically beloved. And he was like, we didn't make enough money. I wasn't expecting us to. You can't be a box office flop and win like a bunch of Oscars.
That must have happened. Maybe it hasn't. Did The Artist make that much money?
Yeah.
That was a surprise hit, right? Yeah.
Moonlight is the lowest grossing Best Picture winner in history.
Wow.
And it made like...
Did all right, yeah.
But that's because you get a bump when everyone
knows
you'll be best.
Brad winning an Oscar,
yeah, and it's going to be fun.
Yeah,
the Brad Pitt cast is going to have oodles.
We'll do special episodes about the Oscar.
Yeah,
Oscar buzz.
Now let's talk about the film that everyone thought he was going to be Oscar nominated for, which is A Nice Dovetail. People thought that A River Runs Through It, he would get at least an Oscar nomination.
Did we work out what year this was released?
I can look it up.
I think it's... Probably like 93, right?
That's possibly true. Did you know that they've cast Prince Eric in the Little Mermaid remake? It just came up on my phone.
Did not know that.
Do you know something about the Little Mermaid remake? That film hasn't come out yet. Do you want me to tell you something about that film?
I didn't even know they were making it. You know what doesn't surprise me, given Disney's recent history? What?
It'll be bad.
Yeah, it'll be terrible. It'll be a total disaster.
Yeah.
What else?
Yeah, that's it. You know what? It'll be bad.
It'll be an awful film. Don't see the Little Mermaid remake.
No. What if nobody showed up to that film? Like, what if the Little Mermaid like defies box office predictions and makes like $3?
I mean, it would be...
We'd win.
The Brad Pitt cast would have its day. I think, but it won't, right? It'll gross like
$800 million.
It'll
be like the 6th highest grossing film of all time. They know that. It doesn't have to be good.
Is it like The Lion King? Is it a real mermaid?
Yeah.
Okay. Animating.
If they do that.
Like disgusting fish skin.
Yeah.
You know what else is a bad movie?
Go on.
A river runs through it.
You looked like you were scared of being cancelled.
Well, I looked like... No, I think I was scared because I don't think I hate this movie as much as you want me to.
You know, Dan, you can do what
I'm
you want.
I'm a free agent.
That's
definitely true. It's... So it begins, A River Runs Through. It sets the tone by having the opening credits run over a series of sepia photographs that are slowly panned across, as in a Ken Burns documentary. And it does not get more invigorating from there. It's an astonishingly bland film.
What if
it's
I like, pretend... What if the bit I had for this episode was that I
You
loved
actually
it.
Loved it?
I don't think I could do it.
I don't think you could pull that off. I think the Joe
I could also
I know,
say nothing. I could not evaluate it whatsoever.
You just describe it.
Yeah. That would be as exciting as A River Runs Through It.
That would, yeah, it would emulate the rhythm and attitude of A River Runs Through It, which doesn't really take a
attitude?
Position on anything.
Yeah. What is this film's... What is...
Brad Pitt is the brother of some guy in 1919 who... The one interesting thing about this film is there's two stages of life. But it opens with these two brothers as like, what, like 6 and 9 year olds. And one of them is played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, the non-Brad Pitt one.
Yeah, GGL, as a little boy.
Yeah, which is
which
fine.
Which means he's older than me. I've always imagined Joseph Gordon-Levitt is about my
That's
age.
That's true. He must be in his like late 30s now.
I was
now,
born
then.
In 90, and A River Runs Through It comes out in 92.
And he looks at least 8, 10.
What the fuck happened to Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
I don't know. Looper, that movie about porn, Don Juan, right?
Yeah, which is... Bad
I've not seen that.
The Oliver Stone Snowden film.
Oh, that's right.
Which everyone thought, like, oh, this is going to get Oscar buzz.
It did not.
You know why?
Bad film.
And I love Oliver Stone. Like, bad film. Genuinely bad film. Which is a real
shame. It is a shame. Citizen 4, a documentary about Edward Snowden, is excellent. Have you seen that?
I don't love it.
I just want to... It's exciting. It's worth seeing. Go see it. We're trying so hard not to talk about A River Runs Through It.
Spoiler alert for reruns through it. It sucks.
Well, so...
It's maybe the worst film
it's,
ever
it's
made.
Not, it's not the worst film ever made. It's a perfectly serviceable... That's crazy. It's biggest crime is being dull.
And what a crime. No, hang on. Its biggest crime is being abrasively heteronormative.
I said that while watching the film.
I'm stealing your line.
I said this film is set in a universe where there is... Nothing that is not heterosexual. Everything is heterosexuality.
Yes. It is the antithesis of everything I go to cinema for.
Yeah.
And Dan, can you please verify for the listeners who know that I am grumpy and irascible and have been rude about most of these movies, that I really tried for the first 20 minutes.
You had a positive attitude. You said, maybe I'll like this.
I said...
Maybe I was unfair to it.
I said, Look, it's been a tough week for everybody. I've not been feeling 100%. I really thought, I'll settle into a calm, meditative film with my friend Dan. We'll eat some vegetarian sausage rolls.
Yeah.
My dog Ida, who's currently sitting next to us.
She'll hang out.
I could see this as being a serviceable film. I can't do it. It is you started saying it like starts with panning over sepia photographs.
And doesn't get more interesting.
There is nothing
I
find
like,
more antithetical.
I quite like Ken Burns. Do you like Ken Burns?
Yeah, I quite like Ken Burns.
It's actually it sounded like I was dissing Ken Burns. I think those documentaries are wonderful and insightful and edifying and quite lovely,
yeah,
and kind-hearted.
But I just...
Well, I've heard complicated things about the politics of Vietnam, but I haven't seen it, so can't comment.
I might. Oh, is there bad...
I think some people said it. It doesn't matter. I don't even remember.
I'm a dingus. I watched that whole thing. I didn't notice anything. This film is just like... It makes me want to go out and do crimes. Because if this is the
vision of
America...
It's not encouraging you to.
No.
Like, I mean, the film is not inciting crimes.
It is by trying to incite the exact opposite.
Yeah.
This film is broadly...
Well, we should talk... We haven't... Like, we've talked about sepia photographs. We haven't talked about the nature of the film.
Okay.
Or, like, the narrative of the film.
Okay.
I don't want to go into it in detail, but we need to give a précis.
Sure.
Brad Pitt and his brother...
Norman is the main character, who is played by Craig Sheffer, who's the lead from Nightbreed, the Clive Barker film, which, if I had my way, we'd just talk about for 2 hours. I've
never seen it.
I think Dan can sense that's what I want to talk about, so he's doing a face that's like, do not talk to me.
I mean, I'd like to talk about Nightbreed, but
it's a great
under
film.
Different circumstances. I think... They're the sons of a reverend.
Played by Tom Skerritt of Alien fame.
Yeah.
Extremely bizarre casting.
Well, he works fine. He's kind of ominous and weird.
I think he's the worst of the four family members.
I think the protagonist... What's his name? Norman.
Norman, yeah.
He's not good.
It's because the film doesn't ask him to do anything.
That's true. He has zero... Nothing is asked of him.
No.
He has no character. You couldn't really describe his character.
No.
They're the son of a reverend. You see them as children. Norman, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt. They go fly fishing with their dad. Then they're older. They're like 18, maybe.
Recounting this plot is aging you. I can see it in your face, Dan.
It's like the rain like in Death Stranding.
Yeah, which we've been playing
Death Stranding,
much.
PS4. Also very boring, as Joe said.
Good boring.
Boring in a different way.
It's interesting how games can be boring in a way that films aren't boring.
It is interesting. Son of a reverend, and they're the son of this woman who is typical of the women in this film, barely a character. It's extraordinary how this film doesn't even treat women badly, it just barely treats them.
And by virtue, treats them extremely badly.
Yeah, obviously.
Mother, all she does is like wring her hands and run around and be like, boys, boys.
But they're barely even engines for the men to have character development. They're just kind of not.
Because there's no development in this film.
No, there's no character. Well, so Brad Pitt is. Once you see them as like in their late teens, Brad Pitt and Norman are with the boys, and Brad Pitt, who is clearly more kind of rambunctious and adventurous and risk-taking. He's a naughty boy.
But a good boy.
I mean, for our purposes, a good boy. But
for the film's purposes, too. The film kind of thinks he's a good boy.
The film wants you to like him, ultimately.
Yeah.
It wants you to be kind of frustrated by him, but like him.
Because, spoiler alert, it kills him.
It kills him off-screen.
In something that's meant to be sad.
In an instance that has nothing really to do with the plot of the film, he just gets beaten to death with the butt of a revolver.
There's no plot
to
this film.
And it's described. There is no plot to this film. He encourages the boys to take a raft down an extremely steep waterfall, or a canoe or whatever, a little boat.
Pitt does,
yeah. And so only his brother is brave enough to go with him. They go down the waterfall. The boys that they're with get worried and think they've died. When they run after them, they see the boat has broken on some rocks, and then Brad Pitt leaps out of some bushes and surprises them. Kind of sets the tone as Norman is the more sensible one, Brad Pitt is the more reckless one. Then some stuff happens.
You're going real fine-grained with this.
Sorry, because I can't remember the broad strokes.
That's it.
The broadest strokes
is it's a family drama with...
And it's, early 20th century.
Yeah.
It's in Maine?
A small town
in Maine.
The fact that it's small town pretends to be part of the film, but really says nothing.
No. Brad Pitt at some point later says he's never leaving Maine. Brad Pitt becomes a journalist. His brother becomes...
A teacher.
Becomes a literature academic. Towards the end of the film, he gets a job offer at Chicago. He falls in love with a girl that possibly Brad Pitt is in love with, but it's not really clear. No, maybe not. No.
And their dad loves fly fishing.
And the dad is a preacher. And he's mad that the boys are kind of rebellious. But not really. And then at the end, they all fly fish together.
And Pitt dies off screen. And the brother's like, that's sad. And then the real life Norman guy who wrote the book stands in a river and ties a fly fish.
So it's based on a memoir. And it's also narrated by Norman throughout. There's some parties in bars. There's some fireworks at one point.
There's a touch on the idea of racism.
Yeah, Brad Pitt's character dates a Native American woman, I think.
Yeah, and who keeps getting kicked out of bars. And that's it.
That really is. There's a guy comes to town whose relation to the central characters I'm kind of unsure of. And then he causes some trouble, but not that much trouble.
And no one really cares.
He doesn't really matter for the plot.
It makes you like Brad Pitt.
Brad Pitt has debts, you find out towards the end of the film. Something that Joe pointed out, kind of, during the out-watching of this film, is that the film kind of makes you think... I'm sorry, this must have been very boring to hear me recount, but let me tell you, if you thought that was boring, nothing compared to watching a river runs through it. The film kind of teases Brad Pitt dying in different ways, or like bad stuff happening to Brad, or him doing bad things.
Because he's the naughty boy.
But nothing bad ever really happens on... Like, at one point you think he's going to get into a fight that's going to be really dangerous. It just doesn't. It kind of peters out. At another point you think he's fly fishing right at the end. They're all fishing together. It's going to be good. Oh no, is he going to drown? No, he's not.
I think the only way I can explain it... So while Dan and I were watching this film, I played, like, a cruel game on my friend Dan, which was that I, like... There's a scene late in the film where they go to a bar. Brad Pitt starts a fight. They come out of the bar and Brad Pitt's like, hey, I'll see you tomorrow. We'll go for that big, big fly fishing event.
Yeah, we'll all go fishing together.
We'll all be happy. And you're really like, ooh. And I said to Dan, what do you think's going to happen?
It's like the cop on the last day of his...
Yeah, exactly.
One
day
away from
retirement.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then...
I started to get convinced due to Joe's going, because Joe has seen this film before for some reason.
I don't fucking talk to him.
And... I was like, oh, Brad Pitt's going to jump off a cliff.
because it then cuts to the next morning and
everyone's together and they're waiting for Brad Pitt
and they're looking at the clock, and I said to Dan, wouldn't it be crazy if Brad Pitt bursts in and is like, hi guys, let's go fly fishing, because the film is so clearly implying that he's dead,
because that would be like what's happening for the last 20 minutes of this film if that happens.
Yeah, and then what does happen?
Brad Pitt bursts through the door
and says
let's go fishing.
What a piece of shit.
It's not, it's a serviceable boring film.
No,
it has some nice shots of landscape, it's inoffensive, it's doing its best.
I find it deeply politically offensive.
Maybe I'm just too normative.
I'm not
sitting down and watching this film for pleasure at any point. I'm not recommending this film to anyone I have met or know.
Well, you said a really interesting thing which I think is worth like briefly litigating, that you were like, so you said that this film is more boring than Johnny Suede, which was the film that we covered last week, but not as good.
I said it's better. Yeah.
Which to me is incoherent. Genuinely. I'm not being a dickhead. That makes sense.
No, but you can have, like, I can see a really terrible painting that's very, like, exciting and, like, messy and a lot's going on, and a very dull Madonna and Child, and the Madonna and Child is a better painting.
It doesn't make sense to me. If I'm excited, then that's good. If I'm engaged.
But what if you're being... So this is... To kind of return to a question from last week then. I said The Room is a bad film and you disagree. Which I think...
Doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, it's obviously a bad movie. It's famous for being a bad movie.
It's not. It's
badly made. It's poorly executed. It makes a lot of bad, unfilmic decisions. It would be more boring if it made better decisions, The Room.
It's not a bad film.
But it's entertaining not because of its quality, but because of its incompetence. Incompetence can be entertaining.
People don't like that film because it's a bad film. They might say they like it. It's because it's a bad film. They like it because it does what good cinema does. It does...
It does exactly the same as good cinema. That's a truism. When you're saying good cinema does things that you're begging the question of wrapping the definition of good cinema into the things that you think constitute good cinema that is just entertainment for you. But that's not quality.
It's not.
That's a different question.
Well, I mean, we were talking about, it can't just be entertainment, because we were talking about Sorkin. And Sorkin is someone who I don't think always makes art that I adore.
Definitely
like, we're talking about The Newsroom. The Newsroom is, I don't adore it, I don't politically align with it. I think it's kind of undeniable as an entertainment machine, in that he's so quick. I mean, you're talking about The West Wing, which I haven't seen.
I love The West Wing throughout my 10 years, and obviously it's corny and has complicated politics, but it entertained the hell out of me. It might be difficult to go back to in this era, but I had a great time watching The West Wing.
Yeah.
And he knows how to write a quick, exciting script.
Yeah.
And the way the character relationships work. It's
and time,
great
doing
fun.
Magic
it's
tricks.
Great fun.
Doing sleight of hand, like card tricks is what Sorkin's doing. He's like, you don't realize that he's setting you up for something that he does.
Definitely.
He's very smart about structure and about character.
Yes.
That for me is not necessarily what I think great cinema is. I think Sorkin has written a lot of very great scripts. So I'm not just talking about entertainment. I guess for me, what the interesting thing about art is seeing preserved intact a way of looking at the world that examining and exploring for the ways that it is cohesive excites me. And Johnny and films that are boring can't do that.
I think I am interested in a film that has an aesthetic position and a kind of social position. I don't want to say moral, but maybe a human position with which I'm sympathetic. And I think I'm more sympathetic with the position of A River Runs Through It than I am with Johnny Suede. Because Johnny Suede, I think, is cruel and too clever for its own good. And those are both things that I find basically unforgivable. Like, there are scenes in it which are far more entertaining than anything in A River Runs Through It. But A River Runs Through It is not doing anything that Ida is licking her chops. It is not either of us.
Which, sadly, is a sign of Greyhound stress. So I don't know what she's stressed about.
We're arguing about the quality of art.
She's like, I actually really liked River Runs Through It. She's 77
She did
dog
watch
years.
The whole thing.
She probably would
but
like
She's River. The target demographic.
She is. In fact...
She wants to bring Brad Pitt home to meet her grandchildren.
Yeah. Ida, is that true?
Yeah, she's given those cow eyes.
Are you a good girl? Do you want to say something on the podcast? Now's your time.
No, just a gaze.
And getting an ear scratch.
Yeah, I think I'm not interested in... Like it's... good art has to do with intention for me. Or has to do with perceived perceived intention. Like, intention as I can imagine it. Because obviously you can never know what an artist thinks. The author is dead, etc., etc. But the reason The Room is not a good film is because Tommy Wiseau thinks he's Tennessee Williams and he's not. That and you can, you, but me. You can, but it matters because you can see the gap. You can see the fall.
I
know
agree.
The fall is interesting, but it's interesting in its badness.
No, I can see the gap, and the gap is where the genius lives.
The gap is not genius. The gap is fascinating because it acts as a demonstration of failure, and failure is interesting. But it's interesting to watch. It's interesting to watch Stephen Bradbury, the Australian ice skater, when in the 2002 Winter Olympics or whatever, coast through the remains of his competitors as they have tangled and fallen over one another. That was not a good run.
But that's not the same, because...
I don't know, that was confusing. That, I guess I was thinking of what failure looks like, and he didn't fail, but I guess the failure of his competitors is interesting. I started to think of people falling over in sports, and it took me to that. But
all I'm thinking
about... No one there is succeeding, but it's a really interesting race to watch. I guess that's my point.
All I'm thinking about, because there is no new art under the sun. So
that's
for me...
That's not true.
You don't think so?
No, definitely not. Obviously there's new art. New art under what, like... New art under what circumstances? Every movie is new. I know they all take old things, but then the word new loses all meaning. Because, so, new. Whenever we say the word new, we mean it within the context of, like, obviously new as distinct from, in particular ways, past experience. And, of course, like...
I think cinema is a constant process of synthesis and resynthesis of pre-existing stuff.
That's...
You look at David Lynch, and all David Lynch...
But that's
Lynch,
what new means.
I get, okay. But, like, but nothing new is being
I still
being
think
added.
That's just not true. I see things that I hadn't thought of before, or, like, new experiences. There are films that are being made today that could not have been made 10 years ago. That's newness.
Ida's dog shaking
out and wandering around.
She's got a toy snake that she's been playing with. It's possible that she's trying to get through the curtains.
Oh, we close the curtains to this room.
Would you mind letting her through?
I'm going to let Ida out.
Sorry.
Ida, come on.
Do you mind leaving it slightly parted so she can...
All right, I'm back.
Thanks, Dan. But I do think it's significant that, like...
Ida's coming back through the curtains.
She's a cat like that. Greyhounds are like that. David Lynch, people talk about the uniqueness of David Lynch. But, I mean, if you want to get, like, cynical about it, all Lynch does is synthesize American sincerity, which exists from, like... You know, Willa
but
Cather
he's not, he's
and
not
puts
sure.
it through Buñuel.
He's not synthesizing it. He's in conversation with it.
And they're... influences that he's absorbed, that he's putting together in ways that are like, oh, that's how you see the world. That's what
sure,
makes
but
his
that's
art
what we're
good.
All, I mean, that's what we're all doing.
I agree.
But that's not, like, that's to mistake the word, that's like to conflate the word synthesis with a bunch of different stuff. Just because in science it means like putting two liquids together and it's those same liquids, that doesn't mean it's the same experience when applied to artistic creation. Totally different things.
You're in conversation
with those things. You're not, you, like... Even like 12 Angry Men, the like shot-for-shot remake, is a new film. Like, it's just like degrees of distance and proximity to other things that have been made previously.
I just think, I mean, if I mean anything more, then I mean that nothing is created in a vacuum. It's always in conversation with old things.
That's absolutely right.
And I don't think it adds up to anything more than... if you want to.
Sorry,
say
I'm probably being too strident.
If you want to make this case that newness is combining two things that haven't been combined before, sure. But I think I'm thinking of it as like, there's no... nothing has been added or created. It's just the same things being put into different Lego box combinations.
That's still... as opposed to what?
As opposed to... sometimes people talk about David Lynch like he comes from nowhere.
Oh,
like he,
sure.
Like he plops in.
Yeah, okay, no,
he
no.
He doesn't
I,
watch. And he...
I accept that.
He feeds into the myth. He's like, I'm not a cinephile. I don't watch movies. Bullshit.
Of
you
course
can
that's
see
not
what
true.
Lynch is.
Yeah.
That's why John Waters, who's very open about the fact that he watches a lot of movies, and David Lynch end up at the same place.
Yeah.
Because they're doing the same project. They're synthesizing images of American suburbia with dark, weirdo, obscure Buñuelian surrealism.
Definitely. No, that's fair.
And I mean, that stuff all matters hugely to me.
Yeah.
But I'm not under the impression that someone's like recreating the wheel necessarily. I mean, this...
okay.
First Reformed is a great example, right?
Like, Winter Light and...
It's
Diary
just
of a
Winter
Priest.
Light and Diary of Country Priest put together. It's all it is. And it still works. And there's still... I guess if you want to say there's something new, it's like you're putting a different combination of things in a way that is exciting.
I hear Joker is just Taxi Driver and King of Comedy, but we haven't seen it yet.
Maybe we'll just never see it.
That would be good.
I think that's what I want to be. That's
more likely at this stage.
I want to be. Yeah, I think I want to see it on Netflix in like 40 years while my kids are like, you're loading up euthanasia drugs as I'm like still doing this podcast, but you're long dead or you've abandoned me and then just talking into it, having arguments with myself.
Who are we doing then?
I'll be like, Shutter Island's good. Movies should be gross. No, all I was going to say about I don't know what the fuck I was going to say about the new synthesis. Literally, what was they saying?
Well, we're liking Johnny's
phone. Wizzo.
Yeah.
I am excited by Wizzo trying to absorb Tennessee Williams in a way that explains his worldview, as I am watching David Lynch try to do American Sincerity.
So this seems like what you want is to be a therapist for directors, right?
I don't
want to
resolve anything, though.
Okay.
I want to see it in process.
You want to be a psychoanalyst.
But yeah, I think to the psychoanalysis point, which is something that you've written about, right? Your PhD, is I want to be in a relationship with an artist who do the same things that I want out of my interpersonal relationship. I want to talk to someone about their taste and learn like, oh, you've synthesized things I didn't imagine could be synthesized. And as a result, you're telling me something very particular about the way that you see the world.
I think I agree that that's really interesting. I think we find the same things interesting or dull broadly. I think what this is a conversation about is just the word good, which is either a boring conversation or a really interesting conversation.
I think, and this sounds like I'm being slightly too mean to you, and I'm not being mean to you because you're my very good friend Daniel Dixon. Sometimes my worry about your description of good... It makes it sound like I'm thinking about it all the time.
No, I like it.
If David Lynch remade The Room shot for shot, you would say that's a good film.
So the thing... I worry a bit about that too, to be entirely honest with you. But I think that with Lynch... I obviously, this causes me anxiety. But I think that with Lynch, it's operating within a vocabulary that suggests that he knows what he's doing. And I think you get flashes in Lynch that show that he's competent. And I will say that Fire Walk With Me, I think, is a film I enjoy. I think it's one of his worst.
Do you know it's something really interesting?
Yeah.
That's my favorite Lynch.
That doesn't shock me.
It's my
favorite. I think there's some stuff in it that just is a mess. And I love Mulholland Drive. And I think that's a very good film. But I think it suffers from having been a TV pilot that's cut down. And I think you couldn't say things like that about The Room, right? You couldn't say like, oh, the reason this sucks is because it doesn't match the original vision of its creator. That's just, those questions aren't even on the table.
Mm-hmm. But this is a conversation we've had before and we'll keep having. And I think I've said something close to this. But like, the moment in The Room when there's a sex scene and you've seen the sex scene for four angles and then it cuts to a fifth angle, which is behind falling water.
Yeah. The like weird rain on the window.
That's clearly not a window because the distance between the things.
It's clearly not rain.
That is everything I want from art. And it doesn't matter to me if Tommy Wiseau thinks that he's imitating something that he's not doing successfully. He has done something that has made me gasp and made me see another human being with an inscrutable mind so foreign to my own that I'm nonetheless deeply compelled by.
I want that from the world, and I think I can get that from art, but I don't think that is part of my criteria of evaluation of art.
Sure.
I think I'm really... It's like having a conversation with someone who you gradually realize is just wrong about the world, but they're wrong in really interesting ways. I wouldn't say that's a person that I want to spend a lot of time with, or that they're kind of a high quality of... I mean, you don't want to evaluate people like that necessarily.
I understand.
They're not objects. But I want different things. Like, I may get an equal amount of enjoyment if we're going to talk in terms of sociality, like wanting to the kinds of things we want in art from interpersonal relationships. I want different things from that I get different things from that interaction than I get from the kind of nourishing conversation that I might have with my friend Joe.
But why is this conversation nourishing? That's because I think we've done the Wittgenstein thing of almost broken down to as basically we can talk about what we find good, and we look at each other's version of that thing and we're like, that's not what I think.
Yeah,
that's why we have this conversation if we came to the same conclusion, we would not be having this conversation.
Sometimes what people say about couples is that you only ever have one argument, you just have it forever.
I mean,
makes sense. And I wonder if the podcast is a version of that.
It's like a very Freudian.
Yeah.
But see, I guess to bring it back to A River Runs Through It, I know from watching this film exactly who Robert Redford is as a director and a writer.
Sure, okay.
And I think he thinks he knows who I am too. And that's the part that's inexcusable. He assumes that we share the same criteria of what's good, what's moving, what's beautiful. And so he's so lazy and so shorthanded with those things because he's like...
That's compelling.
Oh, of course they'll get excited. And that is the antithesis of cinema. I want to see the opposite. I want to see someone go down their own weird Gnostic insular wormhole and I want them to leave me behind.
Okay, alright. I think that's... I understand that perspective from you as a film goer, but don't you accept that that is a very specific type of filmmaking? You can't demand that of all cinema. Robert Redford doesn't expect you to like this film. He's thinking other people will like this film, and they did. The film is not for us. But surely you can't demand that all cinema is about Gnostic wormholes.
But rightly or wrongly, that's what I'm drawn to. In the same way that I think most... I don't want to get, like, weirdly political, but, like, Robert Redford didn't make this film for me because I'm queer.
Sure.
I genuinely think that... What is this film? This film taps into experiences that you have if you have a certain kind of childhood and certain kind of relationships and certain kind of aesthetic judgments that are all tied up in being a straight white male.
Yeah, which, to be fair, I am. I did not enjoy this film.
True.
But I didn't grow up fly fishing in Maine, which might be part of the problem.
But you know what I mean? This is why this film makes me want to, like, burn shit down and break windows.
I totally understand that. This is what John Waters is reacting to, specifically.
And why Waters is so important to me. I think it's also... I mean, we've talked about him before in this episode, but, like, it's also why Todd Haynes is one of my favorite artists.
Sure.
Because he takes this vocabulary with a film like Safe, and with Carol, he's responding to A River Runs Through It, kind of.
Yeah.
He's, like, he's adopting that vernacular and then, like, undoing it from the inside.
A River Runs Through It is not... I mean, it's misogynist. It's very normative. It's not the most egregious example of this kind of film. That's not that I'm not saying that much for it, but that's...
It might also just be the fact that I have, in a last couple of years, made a really concerted decision to only watch what I think I'll like.
I respect that.
So I don't encounter this kind of art very much
anymore. Neither do I.
Maybe that's why I'm so angry about it. Because I can't think of much more that's more straight white male than this.
Well...
Were you going to say Joker? We
haven't seen Joker. No, yeah. Okay. Well, I was... Sure.
What's more... Even stuff that, like... I've been watching a lot of Columbo, and I think people would say that's very, like, middle-class straight white male. It's still subversive to me. It's still, like...
Yeah. It's weird... a critique.
Yeah.
This is not critiquing anything. I mean, the kind of... If this film has an arc, it is the brothers returning to the father, who does not seem like a great guy. In the beginning, he's kind of lecturing and... Not like bordering on abusive, I would say, in some ways. He's making unreasonable demands of his children. Yeah,
he's Old Testament God
for sure.
Yeah,
but they return to the fly fishing with him, and they become the kinds of children that he would have wanted, which is why the tragedy of Brad Pitt is supposed to hit particularly hard when he dies. Is because the times you thought he had died, he hadn't quite returned to the fold, he does, and then he either strays or at least gets beaten to death. So the kind of the fact that he returned and is lost is particularly tragic, or the fact that he returned and departed is particularly tragic. And so it's about proximity to the norm and straying from that, which is the punish is what he is punished for.
Yeah. When you say that, you actually, and I mean, this is kind of what we're talking about, standards of good, that kind of makes me like the film more. If it's like this weirdly, like, if you betray the family unit, you will die.
Which is kind of maybe what it's the I mean, it's not quite Prodigal Son, but it's in that area.
Yeah. I mean, it's worth briefly saying as a bit of context that this is Redford's second film as a director. His first film, Ordinary People, like, wins a lot of Oscars and does, like, extremely well. You know what's interesting? We're recording this at the front of my house, and I'm sure the mic is picking up the conversations of people walking past my house.
Yeah, perhaps.
Wouldn't it be a cool idea for a movie?
If you picked up
someone talking about they've just committed
a
murder.
It's like the conversation, right?
Or Blowout.
Yeah, or the conversation, they're going, like, we're going to commit a murder.
Yeah.
That's more interesting.
Imagine we don't have to stop it. It's two podcasters. Two movie nerd podcasters.
Sounds like a Kevin Smith film.
Oh, Dan, why did you ruin it? You're meant to be supportive of the creative process. What though? What if you're movie podcasters and you just do like murder mysteries and you hear a murder and then it turns out you've completely misinterpreted it and you've just like, you accidentally get someone killed. Like a Rear
Window-y kind of. Yeah. Oh, man.
Coming in 2021.
Yeah. No, we'll do it. We'll head to LA and start pitching.
Yeah. So this is Redford's second film as a director after Ordinary People, which is worth saying, this is basically a slow motion remake of Ordinary People. Ordinary People starts with a family unit of two brothers and mum and a dad, and one of the brothers dies, and then the less liked brother has to like be like fight for his place against his dead brother. And that's kind... This film is about brothers kind of fighting, trying to, like, assemble...
Kind of an across-the-tracks style film.
Do you think... You know, I often think when I like, say something or think something, I think, like, there are lots of people on the planet. How many people are thinking this thing right now? I think every time we think about Across the Tracks, we might be the only people in the world thinking
of it. Yeah.
In that moment, I'm sure Sandy Tom thinks about it. Sure. And Brad Pitt thinks about it.
Yeah, he would have to.
But they're asleep while we're walking around thinking.
The time zones don't match up. I think about that. Like, when I'm on a block in, like, a city, right, a CBD, like, especially a particularly populous one, it's one of the strangest experiences to think I'm the only person, like, late at night, I'm the only person in the world on this particular block right now, on this street. There's no one around me.
Do you know something really unfortunate? 7 billion people in the world,
tell me.
That's a joke in Garden State.
Oh, no.
Have you seen that film?
No.
It is.
New slang.
Oh, yeah, Natalie Portman is like, when I'm feeling creatively crushed, I do a movement no one's in the world's ever done before. And Zach Braff does it too.
Quite what I said.
We're straying into Garden State territory. Actually, you say what film is more aggressively heteronormative? Garden State. I really hate that film. Sure. These two might be in competition for like my least favorite viewing experiences.
Damn.
I just, this film is my poison.
What about Ready Player One? You fucking hated that.
That's the worst film of the decade, certainly. Untouchably so.
I watched it. I watched it in a hotel room in Japan.
That film is like...
I didn't hate it.
Aesthetic and...
I watched the whole thing.
Ethical fascism.
I agree that... Sorry, I say I didn't hate it. Of course I hate that film. It wasn't the... And this is maybe also, like, this is the flip side, right, of my... This is not the worst film we've seen. I would say that I totally am on board with Ready Player One being the worst film of the decade. I wasn't tortured during that viewing experience. I'd say Ready Player One is a worse film than Across the Tracks. It was easier to watch Ready Player One.
Hey, Across the Tracks or River Runs
Through It? Oh, River Runs Through It, sorry.
Which one's worse, are you saying?
Ready Player One is worse, definitely.
No.
But it's easier to watch.
It is definitely easier to watch.
So I think that's kind of what I'm getting at, right? Like, we can make evaluative quality judgments of quality that is separate from the pleasure of our viewing experience. Those things are not necessarily totally linked. They have things to do with one another, but they are separable. And part of the reason we know they're separable is because I can say different things and you know what I mean. Like, as I define each one, you know what I'm referring to.
This isn't me being stubborn and not conceding ground to you, but I think I saw Ready Player One at the cinema where they screen movies to critics with a very big screen and a very loud sound system.
Sure.
So sometimes I think when my hatred of that film, and I've only seen it once,
like is an experiential hatred.
It made me feel really sick. Yeah. I felt really unwell. I had a terrible headache.
Let me say something else about when you say that this is not conceding or whatever. I don't know if this fact about me will surprise you. If I'm arguing with someone, especially someone I like, and they suddenly accept my argument, I feel bad. I'm disappointed.
You could.
I wish I like get upset. I'm like, oh no, I didn't mean to convince you. I didn't want to change your mind.
No. Well, because that's, I think, something we share as people is that, as I say, we ultimately like breaking things down and holding them up to each other and being like, oh, look, how's that different to that?
Sure.
I'm not hoping that you're going to say... I mean, I do force you to watch films that I love. But
I would never watch something I absolutely didn't want to watch.
And also, if you said that you loved them all, I would be disappointed. I don't... Well, maybe I mean,
hated them all.
No, if you loved them... If you loved them all for the reasons that I loved them...
Yeah.
I would be like, oh.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Want to see the ways that...
Yeah, friction. Things coming up against one another. That's interesting.
Guillermo del Toro once said something that really moved me and sticks with me, which is like, you curate your taste, and it's an exciting, interesting project that sometimes tells you things about yourself, sometimes tells you things about the world. It's a complicated process. And if I meet someone who has my taste, it's like fucking the Jake Gyllenhaal film Enemy. Like, I've encountered my doppelganger, and it's creepy. I want to kill for that sure. doppelganger.
Yeah, you have to.
In fact, the people that I hate the most often turn out to be people who I am tortured by the fact they're like, oh, but they like
it's
Cronenberg.
Yeah, it's you seeing yourself in often the things that are most unbearable in others are the things we see in ourselves. Yeah. We can't confront them in ourselves. That's true about me.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
It becomes there's nothing worse than seeing someone with a quirk that you hate in yourself.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, I know. We just went into our own dark place there for a moment. It's true, though. It's true. But this is... So, sometimes I worry, like, am I getting myself too worked up about films like this and films like Ad Astra, which, as you say, maybe have their place, but it's the place is not in my heart and the place is not in front of my eyes.
I think, well, so there's also questions about claims to universality, right? Like, I feel like I'm a... In some sense, I have the sense of good as being a claim to a universal truth, and entertainment or liking as being claimed to a particular experience. And I think the reason I would say that I feel like there are people for whom A River Runs Through It is the experience they are after. And I think it's fulfilling. It's not doing that in a way that, like, you know, Mein Kampf is fulfilling certain things in that people are after. It's doing that in a way that is kind of relatively kind-hearted and...
What the fuck?
That was like the worst artistic object, right? Because you could say the same about that. Bare bones is what I'm saying. Like, you could also say that's fulfilling some people's desires. So I'm not just saying fulfilling people's desires makes for a good work of art, but fulfilling them in a particularly competent and... I fucking hate equating the quality of art with the moral quality because I don't think it's true, but I don't have the energy right now to come up with better criteria. In a thoughtful, kind-hearted, moral way, reasonable. I understand the problems with... I understand the ways in which certain structural toxicities are built into this film. But at the same time, I think you can say it's doing a job and it's not doing it in a mean-spirited way.
I think it is quite mean-spirited.
But not like... Well, I think we're also arguing between, is this like a D minus or a D plus, right? I don't think, like, possibly. I'm not giving this more than 1.5 stars.
No, but I do think, you know...
Maybe I'm giving it 2. Brad Pitt might bring it up to 2 stars.
You know, Foucault talks a lot about... Did I just become a parent of myself? A little bit. But Foucault talks about how, like, you use mental institutions and you use the definition of sanity to exclude.
Sure.
You're making a negative definition. Yes. You're pointing to the insane and you're saying, they're not like us, therefore we're like that. This film feels like it does that for me and is as noxious as a result. It's saying, look at these beautiful, strong boys who perform their masculinity and the film pats them on the back for it and look at their interactions with women.
So I think the only, and again, I'm not forgiving the film this, but I think this makes it more digestible, is I think the only reason the film does that is because that's the only world knows. It's not doing it as, you see some films like this and they're kind of defending from queerness or trying building walls against subversion. I think this film is only familiar with small towns in Maine and it's making a film about heteronormativity in small towns in Maine. And that's not fine, but it's not the worst thing in the world.
Redford comes of age during, like, 70s subversive auteur led film theory.
So is this a... I guess one of the questions is this a reactionary film?
I think it is. Okay. Because Redford's been in films that show that he understands that this is not how the world is for everyone. Like, Redford is something of a countercultural icon.
Sure.
I mean, All the President's Men is not, like, a radically, like... you know, subversive or aesthetically subversive film, but it's a film that pushes against certain portraits of masculinity and, like, how to be. So I think he can't claim ignorance. And I think even if he could, I wouldn't necessarily want to excuse him.
Does he, and I feel like I'm now defending a film that I'm not entirely, in a way that I'm not entirely comfortable with. But does he have to be saying, can't he just be saying this is how the world is for some people?
But,
or does this seem like a totalizing thesis to you? This seems like the ultimate way of being, this is a part... You think this is a didactic film. It's a modelling film.
It's also not a specific film. It's vague and mythic. I think that's my biggest problem. Here's the American myth of the nuclear American family written into
the firmament.
Big, beautiful brushstrokes.
So the thing that you said earlier that compelled me is this is a film that uses a lot of shorthand and expects you to just accept it. I think that's really true of this film. I think it skips... It's weird in that it skips a lot of the kind of substantive emotional stakes mm-hmm. and just presumes you'll accept them. It doesn't feel like it needs to do the work to get you on side. And maybe that's its biggest crime as a normative film, is that it doesn't countenance other ways of being because it presumes that you, the viewer... It presumes the male gaze in like such an overwhelming way.
Yeah. That's what I mean. It pretends to be like, this could be anyone, but it couldn't be me. And in fact, the fact that it presumes that it could be me is like deeply insulting to me. I don't know any of these people, and I deeply resent the insinuation that I am in any way like them, which maybe sounds like I'm being obstinate and difficult, but I think it's true. I think when the culture starts being like, isn't this relatable? The culture is making some profound claims that, inadvertently or not, often quash other ways of being in a way that, like, people carry a lot of hurt.
I think genuine that's fair. Hurt. Yeah.
It kind of sounds... Because, I mean, this... I can understand why you're like, is this film dangerous? But it's as dangerous as any art as I feel like I encounter. Because something like... Dan just made this. What is this podcast if me not curating that face out of you, Dan, one way or the other? I feel like most people are culturally intelligent and sensitive enough to see something really reactionary and gross, and the majority of people see it like that.
Mm.
But a film like this that's like, how could you hate it? It's so harmless.
It's covering it.
Handsome.
Yeah.
It, because it's so normative... people don't react against it like you don't have like a, you know, do you know the film, a Serbian film?
I know of it. Of course I haven't seen it.
I don't think you should see it.
Thank you.
I can excuse. Well, I mean, because the whole point of that film is it's wholly experiential, and the experience is the experience that you run from in cinema.
Isn't it just notoriously cruel and violent?
It has some horrendous things. I think it might be a masterpiece, but I'm aware that I'm only saying that because I'm slightly deadened in a way that I think you would just find it traumatizing. And, like, I think if you can...
It's...
Go on.
Is that not just the George Lucas wringing a puppy's neck thing?
You should say that quote. That might be a shorthand that maybe we just have.
I think you remember it better than me, right? It's like George Lucas has said, anyone can get an audience to...
Anyone can get a reaction out of an audience. All you need to do is wring a puppy's neck. That's him defending, like... when he's, like, making, like, weird cold films like THX. And everyone's like, why don't you just... make people feel something, George, and he's which is funny because he goes on to make the film that most tries to make you feel something.
Yeah, symphonic cliche ever. I love Star Wars, but still,
I think horror cinema is at its best when it deadens your rational faculties, like it, and you afterwards you have to contend with something so horrible that you have to form your own thesis about it on top of the work that's not coded into the work.
I think, yeah.
That's what Serbian film does.
I think this might be... Our separate feelings on that might be inextricably linked to the argument we were having about quality. And it has to do with what... Like, the fact that I could behave in such a way that you would feel that now, right? I could, like, freak out and do unexpected things and be cruel. But that doesn't seem... Like, I know exactly what I would need to do. I'm not, like... mapping out a plan or a strategy, right? But like you can imagine like a set of it's not that hard for me to creatively imagine a set of things that would ruin someone's life.
Sure.
And I think that's I want hard work, and I think I want hard work that pays off in a way in which I understand the relation between the care that was put into the craft and the output. And I don't see something like that in The Room, and I struggle sometimes to see it in egregious horror.
But I think what you're talking about is that, like, you could replicate those things is why many people, myself included, are drawn to horror. Because when you have an artistic experience, you sign up for it, and it happens for a certain amount of time, and then it stops, and you have catharsis, and you can feel something that is not neat and pat. I mean,
I hate neat, and it's the reason I keep returning to horror, even though I find it traumatizing, is because it's a place for ambiguity, it's a place for surrealism, it's for messiness.
When I say neat, I mean neater. I'm trying to skirt something that would just, like, kill the... But if, like, we all have unpleasant things in our past. Sure. watching horror is sometimes a way of contending with unpleasant things in a way that you have control over, that you can start and stop and come to emotional resolution.
I'm not against horror in general, and I totally understand that. I think this just has to, and the experience of it, I think this just has to do with
But I mean, if you're saying, like, you can upset me in an intersocial way, that's why, A, I don't think it's as easy for movies to upset you in that way.
That's true.
And B, the fact that you can do that to me because I'm a thing in the world and a human being is why I want to watch horror films. I want to explore that. I want to see that. I want to test that. I want to play with intuitions in response to that. And I don't want it to happen to me.
Sure.
You seem unconvinced.
There's just no, I'm not unconvinced at all. There's just a lot of stuff involved there, right? Certainly. Like, it's a complicated philosophical question.
Certainly.
Because I'm also not, I'm absolutely not against horror. I just feel I'm not interested in horror as such. It has to be horror done well, and I think we just have different, I don't know. I also don't think, like, you're wrong about this. Like, I obviously don't think that you're making, like, mistakes about what you consider quality to be. I'm just trying to work out what we mean when we talk about what's good.
Sure, which for me is the purpose of art itself. I want to see someone who's telling me what they think is good, and if it's inscrutable to me, I'm so excited. So it's also the process of seeing that. You know, this is something that kind of dovetails in. I guess sometimes I feel like I bang the same boring drum. My drum at the moment is Todd Haynes.
Yeah.
He's always been a really important filmmaker for me. He's got a new movie coming out. I'm so excited. We're getting good think pieces. There was an amazing profile about him. The joy of reading this long form profile about Todd Haynes is
it's in the New Yorker, right?
In the New Yorker. It's so good. It goes through his whole life. It's like, but why it's so good for me is because it tells me things that I already knew from his art.
Yeah. And that which is, you know what, also is something we experienced today, watching the interview with Brad Pitt.
Yeah. He doesn't tell me anything new because he's revealed it to me already.
Yeah, and it's extraordinary. That's a marvelous. Well, it's your, and I think probably my as well in a different way, interest in literalism. Mm. It's an interest in earnestness, and it's also why we link these questions of relating to art to questions of sociality, because I taught a David Foster Wallace story recently.
Mm-hmm. Good
and
old
it's
Neon.
Good old Neon, yeah. And it's the one where, well, it's a lot about fraudulence.
Yeah.
And a lot of the students, I kind of was thinking about this afterwards, were talking about how, oh, you know, we're always pretending, we're always showcasing a mask to the world. It's just not true. We reveal ourselves constantly as if we have embarrassingly.
Yeah,
and that's
sucks.
Like, to be in the world is to reveal yourself. It's not like people have this idea that you perform different people for different groups and whatever.
No.
Kind of, but you're just working out different ways of accidentally showing who you really are. And
it's the great...
Also what's wonderful about art, right? Yeah. And I think that might be where we can kind of find common ground, and maybe where I can become more sympathetic to your perspective, is what's fascinating about art is the ways in which people, and it doesn't matter if it's intentional or unintentional, but showcase something of themselves, their self, through what pretends or like imagines itself as curated or structured in a way that is like a little bit distanced from the self. And acting is the most wonderful example from that, because it's called acting. It's like, it's as if it's projection of another person through the individual. Whereas what we're interested in is the actor.
Mm-hmm.
And with Brad Pitt, you get this extraordinary connection between his way of inhabiting the world and then the way in which that expresses itself in different realms. It's not him pretending to be other people. It's the Brad Pitt's gesture and expression functioning in new contexts through new imagined experiences. And that's much more interesting because you're learning about the kind of minute details and facets and textures of a person in ways that are far more specific than you usually get to when you're just kind of like looking at them from a distance.
Mm.
It's the personal that like he imbues his performances with the same kind of personality that you would experience in a close friend.
Yeah. Whereas Robert Redford in this film does not. He doesn't reveal anything to me about him as a person because he's gesturing towards shorthand that he assumes exists.
There's no room for him.
There's no room for him. And that's what I mean about, and what you're saying too, there's not, you know, I read the Haynes profile and I'm delighted because I see the things that he's talking about things I've already seen in the art. What does Redford say in an interview about this film that I mean, what the fuck does he say?
Might talk about liking the book.
This film has told me nothing about who Robert Redford is. So I read an interview. He could say anything. He could say, like, he watched 48 hours of, like, snuff films to prepare for this. Or he could, like, study paintings for hours. Because the film hasn't revealed anything. And it hasn't revealed anything because he's assumed that he's looking at you, the audience, the viewer, and he's being like, surely this will activate this in you. And I don't care. I want him to be selfish.
And the wonderful Brad Pitt moments in this are kind of the little pauses in between dialogue where you see, like, these various senses of being flash across his face in really genuinely wondrous ways. He's by far the best performer in this film. It does, like, it's not that I, obviously, look, I'm doing a Brad Pitt podcast. I have an affinity for Brad Pitt. But sometimes I think, is he a good actor? Like, what is he doing? How much, like, especially this last round of films. But watching this, he is not accidentally making things interesting. He is very skilled at what he does. He's making, and even if the decisions are, like, who cares if they're at a conscious level or an unconscious level? Like, that's not even at play. He's inhabiting the character in fascinating ways and making, it's a far more nuanced and it's a human performance in a way that everything else in this film is abstracted except Brad Pitt. He's this concrete particular thing that is moving through this film, which is just surrounded by, like, the most cliched American landscapes that you'd find in some, you know, $2 shop, like an op shop painting.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's kind of, suddenly you see this human in them.
I mean, this, we're only very early in the Pitt journey, but everything we've covered so far is, to me, like, oh, he is my favorite. Like, he really is my favorite. Already, I kind of already knew that, but I'm just convinced now that, like, I light up. Even when he's bad, I light up. And he's good in this film. He's in a film that I hate as much as any other. And he acquits himself so wonderfully.
Mm.
And he does. He's so good in this film. He is the best. I always love to see him.
That is an interesting thing about you, Joe, is sometimes we'll be talking about a film and you'll say you don't like it. And then I'll mention, like, an actor in it and you'll say, oh, they're great. And I wonder what that means. I mean, we don't have to get into it now. But, like, how can this be one of the worst viewing experiences? How can this be with Ready Player One if Brad Pitt gives a star-making performance in it?
Because he's not the author. He's the author of a corner of the film.
I thought you didn't care about authorial intention.
I don't care if it's... I don't care about intention.
You care about getting a view of the person. Yeah,
I do care about the author. They don't have to be on purpose.
No, I get it. It's what access you get to them, or what is...
Yeah.
What do you understand about their worldview?
I'm still obsessed with Tommy Wiseau as an author. I'm just obsessed with questions of did he mean to do that? Course. I'm just obsessed with how he thought about the world. So Brad Pitt he's not really, we've seen films before where he's, like, bucking against the film. He's quite in line with the film, largely.
But that's true.
He's carved out a little space that makes him, like, I also don't think, well, I don't think Brad Pitt hates me. And I think it's possible that Robert Redford hates me.
I think that's true. And I think you get that sense from this. Yeah.
Yeah. Brad Pitt certainly, I mean, he's a wackadoo. You see in the Variety interview, Robert Redford is not a wackadoo. Robert Redford is, like...
He's sensible.
Stern, Obama voting, like, and...
Hey, there's another look.
Should we do that?
We're like, no, I'm going to neither defend nor endorse Obama. But Obama voting is not the most egregious thing you can
do. My favorite meme on the internet. Like, when you're a socialist, or even, you don't even have to be very far left to, like, butt up against the fact that Obama supporters, because Obama, like, bombed people and killed people.
I'm fucking not going to get into that conversation.
But it's so fun.
I don't endorse drone strikes.
Did you see the meme where it's like, you know, you run into it liberals all the time and they're like, well, if that's your definition of war criminal, and then Barack Obama must be a war criminal. And your response is just, okay. Yes, I agree. You know that Redford makes, like, an insanely, like, pro-Obama, pro-liberal America film called Lions for Lambs?
Oh, it's
hard to imagine. I mean, maybe that film's worse than this film.
Okay.
But it's so, like, weird as an object that I have more of a, like, bad reaction against it. Can we... very quickly.
Oh my god.
Do Letterboxd.
Yes. You did say, and I'm happy to do this.
I introduced it last week by saying you don't want to make it a segment.
Send in theme songs for Brad Pitt Letterboxd film check.
Yeah.
Segment.
You know what? I've just opened my Twitter and someone I don't think I even follow tweeted a scene from There Will Be Blood. The scene at the end where Daniel Day-Lewis...
We argued about that last week.
We did. Because you're right. You're wrong about it, man. The scene where Daniel Day-Lewis goes for a swim in the ocean at the end because he's got the pipeline all the way to the ocean. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, I do.
It's
good. It's a great film. It's one of the best films of the decade, definitely.
Is it this decade? No, it's not.
Really?
No, The Master is, I think.
Oh, wow. It's
that I know. Old. Time moves so fucking fast, Dan.
Decade. Goddamn.
There Will Be Blood is 2007.
For sure. Look up the film on Letterboxd.
My phone's running out of battery too, so we're in a weird place. So A River Runs Through It has the weirdest Letterboxd score rating that I've ever seen. It has almost no one's given it anything less than 2.5 stars. Almost no one's given it anything more than 4 stars.
Okay.
So everyone thinks it's just fine, except for Joseph Earp, who thinks it's terrible. Reviews. There's 342 reviews. I won't. I'll start with the ones that we agree with, that we understand these
Who's
people.
Who's giving it 1 star?
These people are giving it 3.5 stars.
Oh.
Robert Redford's film meanders.
Yes.
Occasionally loses its way.
Does it have a way, even?
I guess. It's meant to be, like, bucolic and folksy, I guess.
Yeah.
At times gives you what you need, and at times leaves you dry.
Maybe. As boring as the film. What are you being talked around by a 3.5 star?
I couldn't... No, I'm saying I can understand that. This person's making claims that I can understand that I don't share.
Okay, sure.
That's all I'm saying. We're gonna slowly get to ones that I do not understand. All
right.
This is one I definitely understand. 3.5 from Aiden. Do you want me to tell you Aiden's top 4 films?
Love to hear them.
Kind of interesting. Apocalypse Now.
Sure.
Good film. We talked about that.
It is a good film.
The Shining. Uncontroversially great film.
I think so.
Jeremiah Johnson is the film that Redford does the nod in. That's the meme. To bring it right around to Robert Redford. That's Jeremiah Johnson. And Badlands. Bad film. Terrence Malick. Bad filmmaker.
We'll
get to him. Yeah, I'll save some for fucking Malick later. Aiden says Brad Pitt circa 1992 is the metric by which all other men are measured. I agree.
Wow. I reckon you wait a few years, but sure.
That's true. This person, Jake, this is where we get into, like, I don't know who you are. And the top 4 films kind of, although they're all kind of good films, they just look weird side by side. Before Sunrise.
It's a... fucking great film.
So sad. Maybe one of the saddest
films. I saw that
films.
At the cinema by myself, not in a great place, and it like ruined me for a week.
Have you heard Linklater's story about what it was based on? That it was based on his experience with a woman who died in a motorcycle accident?
Yeah. I'm so sorry. Sorry to this man.
Sorry to this man. Fantastic Mr. Fox, which is Wes Anderson's best film.
I might agree. I like Wes Anderson almost certainly more than you do. Rushmore's
like
fucking great.
Much. Rushmore is good. I'll go out for Rushmore. Good Will Hunting.
Oh.
That is weird. I don't understand the person who thinks that's
B-.
An old timer.
Yeah.
And Casablanca.
One of maybe the greatest film ever made.
Dan, shut up.
It's just obvious. You're definitely like, I'm on the right side of history, dude.
It's not. Nah, not very good film, Casablanca.
Fucking crazy. Unhinged.
Jake says, this is crazy to me, he gave this film 5 star. I've already proved this person is inscrutable to me. I'm currently on a walk at 12:30 a.m. because of this movie. Does he live in like rural?
Maybe he's like a, you know who I kept thinking of through this film?
Go on.
Annie Dillard.
Yeah,
the bucolic essayist.
Yeah,
and I imagine this is her country.
Yeah.
But
Dillard writes about Christianity and nature, which this film touches on both.
I like Dillard.
Dillard kind of irritates me sometimes.
She's irritating. I think she's a wonderful writer.
On a sentence by sentence level.
Yeah, and structurally, I think she's morally interesting. Anyway, but this film fails to live up to kind of Dillard's vision of America.
It's true. I hadn't thought of Dillard. She makes sense. I kind of thought, which is a weird thing for me to say because I hate this film and I love Raymond Carver, but I kind of thought a bit of Carver.
Well, this film wants
to
be a novel. I mean, it's based on a memoir, right?
Yeah.
Well, imagine what going on, because it so, like, shook your psyche. What are you, like, honestly, what's the existential experience there? Like, I don't know. Like, what are you reflecting on?
Yeah,
I genuinely don't know.
Family.
Maybe it's like if you've seen Hereditary or Ad Astra and they play into your, like, specific Freudian neuroses.
Yeah.
This has some, like, if your dad's a reverend and your brother fly fishing brother got beaten to death with the butt of a pistol.
Such a horrible
I'd go on a walk
detail.
At 12:30 a.m. if that happened to me.
Horrible. I'd be going on a walk at 12:30 a.m. every night. This film would not prompt that. I'd already be doing that walk. Russ Mann is this guy. is top four films. I love this game. Do you not love this game?
No, I'm having a good time.
These people are inscrutable to me.
This is what you want, right?
I want to be like, who the fuck are you? Who are you?
The world is keep presenting those people.
Yeah, Joe. I'm so excited. Every day is a blessing. It's top four.
Is that why you like animals?
Yes.
Okay.
110%. I am irritating and obnoxious, but I'm a little bit coherent.
Yeah, not only one of those is true.
Which
the little bit coherent. No.
Top four films: Das Boot, The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. Crazy.
I really like it.
I think it's.
I know why you dislike it, and I understand. I think that has some truly marvelous interaction. Look, I know it's got our two friends who should definitely be cancelled but aren't, Jeff Goldblum and Bill Murray.
Don't get a suit. Okay. I'm looking out for you. Are you looking at the waveforms to see if you can cut that out? Jeff Goldblum and Bill Murray are not listening to this podcast. Murray is quite inscrutable.
Murray is inscrutable.
So maybe. You could imagine him searching through podcasts that from the least watched, least listened to, and like working his way up. That man freaks me out. Life Aquatic does the thing that I think River Runs Through It. It like gestures towards things that I should be moved by, that I should understand, that I don't. A father mourning his dead son in a helicopter accident. Like, I think the film does that really lazily, the Owen Wilson death, in a way that, like...
I agree. I think actually Wes Anderson, apart from Rushmore, is terrible at death. I think he trivializes it. He tries to... Like, but, I mean, Wes Anderson films are about playing out a fantasy in order to avoid the worst things in life, and the fantasy failing to function and falling apart, and so everyone comes back together. That's like, every film is about that.
I hadn't really thought about that. It's very compelling.
I think definitely. And I think
that's why Grand Budapest for me fails terribly.
I fucking hate Grand Budapest. It invokes so narcissism. Yeah, it does not work.
Overstates itself.
I agree. I was furious that was his like best received film. I think Anderson at times is a master. Anderson was mentioned in Scorsese's op-ed about Marvel films. I think Anderson can be a great filmmaker. And I think, again, Tenenbaums is about these people trying to like construct a fantasy world, and like Anderson replicates his fantasy world. And it fails. Yeah. And that's, I think, what makes this film good. It happened. But I do think it doesn't quite get it. Like, it's the problem with Life Aquatic is that death is treated too trivially.
And he has sympathy for the people building the fantasy world. That's definitely what makes him who he is.
Yeah.
He doesn't think these people are stupid. No. He's like, we all do this.
And Rushmore just does that so beautifully.
Rushmore is a great film.
Yeah.
I don't know why I will instinctively say that I hate Anderson, because he's made some films I really like.
Yeah.
Just the ones I don't like.
I really don't like Grand Budapest. And that made me rethink him, to be honest. I would have said he was one of my two or three favourite directors.
It's
silly, and I'm worried about Jojo Rabbit.
Oh, I don't like Taika Waititi as a general rule. Sure. I don't know. I mean, maybe that film does something, but it looks like it's like fluffy take on Nazism.
Which just stop like...
No, don't just want
to. Who's doing the real Holocaust? Oh, Glazer.
Yeah, Glazer.
Yeah, real Holocaust film.
That's how you do it. I think there's some truth to that.
Based on Martin Amis's The Zone of Interest, I think.
Which is not real Holocaust. That's a romantic comedy set.
Okay. I haven't,
I don't know how he's going to do it.
Well,
but we'll one find of my out. All-time favorites. Yeah. So.
Glazer.
Yeah.
Not Amos.
I love Amos. I'm ride and die for Amos.
All right.
Which is very unpopular, it's I feel.
Rare. But you know he wrote an Atari guide, Martin Amos?
No.
Yeah. When he was just doing stuff for money.
What a genius.
Sure.
Run Silent, Run Deep is this guy's...
What are we even talking about?
This Russ man's four favorite film. So I don't know what the fuck that is about. His entire review, 3 stars. Rejected sequel ideas. A river death runs through it. I don't know what that means.
I will say that I do not know. It's the sentence is said towards the end of the film. Water haunts me is the last sentence, which is fucking crazy.
It's so bad.
There's a meaningful monologue at the end of this film, which really, if anything, would have convinced me that this is a true disaster of the film. It's unraveling in the final scene where... The old Norman is looking back on his life and narrating.
It's because the happened. Film treats that like a slam dunk.
Yeah,
it's like you're but just it doesn't make any sense.
Like no. Water did not like he didn't. Water did not have a particularly strong role in the film. No. The symbolism of it isn't earned. No. But he does say during that he says something about he learns that everything forms into one and a river runs through it. Yeah. But the object that the one is referring to isn't really clear. So the it through which the river runs, which is in the title of the film, the noun that refers to is. Ambiguous.
It's a piece of shit. It's bad.
I think it's bad writing.
Yeah, it's awful writing, which does not fare well.
Genuinely bad writing.
which didn't necessarily need to, I mean, this could be a terrible film, but an okay book.
Yeah.
I just want to read you two more.
Two more.
Sneh. This person's username is Sneh. Their four favorite films are, they're half a genius and half I don't know who this person is. Mission Impossible Fallout, one of the films of the decade. Number two, Paper Moon. Paper Moon is great. Have you seen Paper Moon?
No.
It's like a throwback screwball comedy by Peter Bogdanovich. Is the only good film.
Yeah.
And then these two, First Man by Damien Chazelle. Terrible film.
Chazelle, so possibly the director of the next Brad Pitt project. Yeah,
which is bad news for me. I fucking hate Chazelle. I hate him for the reason I hate Redford. He gestures towards things that don't make sense to me.
Yeah.
And Room, the Brie Larson. Oh,
I haven't seen that, but I can't imagine it's good.
Oof, sorry, Snare. But fantastic review. I'm sure something happened in this movie other than Brad Pitt looking hot, but I literally couldn't tell you a thing.
I understand that.
100%. Last one. I'm not going to read all of it because this person is inscrutable to me and writes a lot. Billy Stevenson, top four films, Risky Business.
Billy Stevenson's Halftime Walk. Billy Lynn's Halftime Walk.
That would be pretty funny.
Yeah.
Risky Business.
Oh, Tom Cruise.
The Tom Cruise film. Halloween, the John Carpenter film, is great. The Sidewalk Ends, the throwback noir film. The Cranes Are Flying.
Never heard of it.
Russian film.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Have you seen all movies?
I haven't.
It's fine. We don't need
I can
to
list
to that.
The ones I haven't seen. I haven't seen Joker. This guy gave it 4.5 stars. here we go. Okay. Robert Redford has always been a passionate curator of nostalgic Americana. That's probably true.
The strongest argument for this film, if there is one.
Makes me hate Robert Redford.
Also, yeah, that's what Trump is also a passionate curator of nostalgic Americana.
But he brings a particularly elegiac edge to A River Runs Through It. Hang on, A way of life, a conservative way of life. I really think that is. Okay. It is the face of Thoreau. The face of Emerson, and that's an incredibly imaginative and innovative cinematic vision.
Wild. I like Thoreau and Emerson.
I like them both too, but this film is radical.
They're transcendentalists.
Yeah, and they're weirdly radical.
Because
they've been canonized, everyone thinks that they're like
weirdos.
Sturdio. They're crazy, yeah. Still, Pitt's face is what remains. That and the landscape it generates, and between them there's tonic enough to leave the soul restored in imagination stirred.
Nothing I fucking love more than amateur reviewers who have clearly
waited
to like
be a big
draft
deal.
Five.
No, Dan, because I do that too. You have to have sympathy for these people. I'm not making fun of him.
But I'm sure you're okay. It's just the careful writing is quite funny to me.
I love that though, because it means that I could argue with them about it.
Sure.
It doesn't feel like they've gestured towards something lazy. It feels like I could be like, Billy, cut. Really? Do you have final words? What do you give this as out of a star rating? Have we gone extremely long for this episode?
A little long.
We can have a bumper episode.
Okay. For A River Runs Through It.
Yeah. It's
no, I'm down. As long as I hope people stayed till the end.
If they didn't,
that's
fine.
That's okay too.
If
yeah, we forgive you.
If you did,
thank you though.
I love you.
Yeah.
I genuinely love you.
Mm.
In the way that I love
Tommy Wiseau.
Tommy Wiseau. In exactly the same transactional
relationship. Yeah, why are you still listening?
Yeah, why are you here? Who are you? What do you want?
We can't see too many details in our stats, but we can see which cities people are listening in. And we've got people in Japan, in Chile.
Yeah.
Hi to Chile. Unless you're a bot that downloaded the podcast, in which case, fuck you. You're screwing with our stats.
Bots can listen. It means that the bots won't execute us when the bot revolution happens.
That's good. Yeah, no, unless they hate Brad Pitt.
Oof. Unless they love A River Runs Through It.
That's true.
Go on.
1.5 stars.
Okay.
You've talked me down from... I could have given it... I almost tempted to give it 2 for Brad Pitt.
You could give it 2. I wouldn't react.
I mean, what am I like?
What's the 2 stands for?
Yeah, what
you
is
didn't
it for?
Seem like you're enjoying.
I was
it
checking
at
my
all.
Phone.
Yeah,
1.5 stars.
Also, we had the time pressure that for the last half hour that it was Ida's walk time, and she was
that's true. I wanted
really
to go
telling
a walk.
Us that
she
it
was also
walk.
Bored with A River Runs Through It.
It was a real. It's the definition of tragedy, right? It's like players who hate what they're doing but continue
that's
to do
true.
It. Everyone was hating it. Yeah, I give it 1/2 star.
Sure.
I think it's the worst film that we've covered.
We'll spend the rest of this podcast litigating what is meant by best and worst. But I understand that.
Dark Side of the Sun, I'm like, who are you? And I have fun.
I'm like
that
too, but
it's
a... Yeah, sure. We've been there.
We could rehash it again. Let's make it a 3-hour episode. Let's do it all.
I'm not editing this.
Am I editing it? You're shit. Editing this one. Okay, well, I'm leaving everything in.
Okay.
In fact, I'm putting it into slowdown. So it sounds like, you know, they did 24-hour Psycho, where it's like, oh, Psycho, yeah, slowed down.
There's to the DeLillo novel about that.
Yeah, it's a great
Point
novel.
Omega. Point Omega. Yeah, it's a good novel.
One of his best. Yeah, I'm going to make this so it's just like for 48
I wonder, you know how Netflix, they say you can change, like they're testing a speeding up of films.
Yeah.
Can you also slow them down?
That would be fantastic. Yeah. You could, I was actually thinking, because something about Brad Pitt that we haven't really touched on is that his face moves, he has very lots of microtransactions in his face. You could just like cut out everything but Brad Pitt close-ups in this film and slow them down.
Maybe we could do an art project of 24-hour Brad Pitt where it's just close-ups on Brad Pitt, slowed.
And seeing him get older. Just,
yeah, and then younger for Benjamin Button and then older again.
Dan, we should do that.
I would start putting together
like a weirdo proposal. Art moniker, like...
Oh, yeah, what's the name of that? Or
something like that. Ida.
That's Ida's great.
Yeah, we should be Ida.
We can be Ida.
And our press photo can be like us in white suits with like red paint splattered on them. And
yeah, we're just standing expressionless, arms by our sides.
Yeah, all posed across each other.
That's true.
Like I'm sitting in a chair, you've got your hand on my shoulder.
Oh, absolutely.
Ida.
Yeah. Yeah, all caps.
We would have to delete this podcast, though, if we got
famous. Oh, if we became like the AdWord or whatever.
Yeah, because we would not want to know people who we were. We would not want people to be constructed.
No.
Same if we sell our podcast microphone script.
Oh, yeah, for sure. No, we have to eliminate this from the internet. Everyone who's downloaded it will have to delete it from their devices.
We'll send a nice email. You keep looking at the time.
I'm not sure how much we'll cut out, but the clean edit, the unedited version is over 90 minutes now. So,
if we went for another half hour, we'd be as long as River Runs Through It.
Is that a challenge? That was a terrible experience.
It was. We had fun.
I haven't had dinner.
I know. It was shit. True. And we were going to watch Watchmen.
We were thinking about it.
I don't like it anymore.
Okay. We've only watched 2 episodes. It's probably bad. I think it's bad.
Yeah. That was a little dud of a side for a plot that I suggested. Right, yeah. Next week.
Cool World.
I am so excited.
I've never seen it. I'm not even sure what reasons. It is.
It's like a weirdo, horny, quite offensive take on Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
I cannot imagine anything less like A River Runs Through It.
Beautiful. They come out in the same year.
Crazy.
92. But Cool World is lots of animation. So that's why.
Fascinating.
This film's been in the works for way long. So that's why it just looks like this weirdo thing. Done by Ralph Bakshi, who did the Fritz the Cat.
Fritz. Sorry. Weirdo. Yeah,
total weirdo. It's the joy of seeing someone inscrutable make a work of art.
Can't wait.
See you next time. Thanks, guys.
Bye.